Support for this podcast comes from Is Business Broken, a podcast from Questrom School of Business. Stick around until the end of this podcast for a preview of the first episode, a conversation with Dean Susan Fournier, where she answers the question at the heart of the show.
This is On Point. I'm Anthony Brooks, in for Meghna Chakrabarty. And Jack Beatty, tell us what Goofy kicking Donald Duck has to do with a balance of power in Washington.
Well, that is a raffish cognomen for a flagrant gerrymander in Pennsylvania following the 2010 redistricting, and it may prelude the kinds of gerrymanders we see deciding the 2022 election. The district ran across five counties, 26 municipalities. At its narrowest point, it ran through the parking lot of a seafood restaurant in the town of King of Prussia. It was about the width of a plate of fried clams there. Its symbolic point, though, was the point where Goofy is kicking Donald in the rump. And, of course, that's exactly what this plan of politicians picking the voters, that's exactly what the plan was doing to democracy.
All right. Well, that, of course, is On Point's news analyst Jack Beatty joining us from Hanover, New Hampshire. And we're talking this hour about the battle over redistricting, the once-a-decade process to remap congressional districts. Right now, Republicans have a big advantage because they control most state legislatures where the work gets done. And their work could help them retake the House in 2022 and determine the balance of power in Washington for the next decade. So this hour, On Point, we're talking about the battle over redistricting, gerrymandering, and the state of American democracy, nothing less. And Jack, talk a little bit more about the history of this and where we are today with the process and what's at stake.
Well, the history, I mean, the term gerrymander goes back to 1812. It was built on a cartoon actually drawn by Gilbert Stuart, the great painter, in a Boston newspaper, which showed a salamander wrapping around Boston's North Shore, going from town to town. And across it, Stuart wrote gerrymander after Elbridge Gerry. He had a hard G, who was the governor who'd come up with this gerrymander to fix his party in power. The Boston Gazette referred to it as a new species of monster. And of course, it's been nibbling at democracy ever since. As you said at the beginning, it's the politicians picking the voters rather than the other way around. But this time, in this election, it may actually devour democracy because, of course, if the Republicans win the House in 2022, well, let's put it this way. Lynn Cheney says that if Kevin McCarthy had been Speaker last year, he would have thrown the election results out of the House, giving Donald Trump the presidency and setting off the worst crisis in the Union since 1860. In effect, that could happen again in 2024, if the Republicans win the House.
All right. So lots at stake. Listeners, tell us what you think. You can post a comment on social media, Twitter or Facebook at On Point Radio. And I'd like to introduce Michael Lee. He's a senior counsel for the Brennan Center's democracy program. He focuses on redistricting, voting rights and elections. And he joins us right now from Ilion, New York. Michael, great to have you. Welcome to On Point.
Thanks for having me.
Why is this such a pivotal moment for redistricting, and how is it different from past years?
Well, this is going to be an especially fraught and challenging redistricting cycle for any number of reasons, not the least of which it will be taking place at an odd point in the year. You know, normally states would have already gotten the data that they need to draw maps. They would have gotten it in February or March, and they would be off to the races to draw maps. But now that data won't come out until the middle of August, which means that redistricting will take place in the fall, oftentimes in special sessions. And you know, states are going to have to rush to get maps done in time for the 2022 election cycle. But it's also going to be a difficult cycle because, you know, the legal landscape that applies to how maps are drawn has changed quite a bit. You know, in 2013, the Supreme Court struck down Section 5 of the Voting Rights Act, which required states with a history of discrimination, mostly in the South, to get maps pre-approved before using them. And then in 2019, the Supreme Court ruled that partisan gerrymandering claims can no longer be brought in federal court. which is
now,
really
Michael, just stop there, just to be absolutely clear. So the Supreme Court basically said no problem with partisan gerrymandering. Is that right?
That's right. At least in federal court, some state courts are willing to police, but and that really has opened green lighted the potential, going even more wild this time than the states did last time. But last time was really bad. But now they sort of gotten the green light from the Supreme Court to do whatever they want, as long as it's for partisan reasons.
Right. And if you would respond to what Jack Beatty raised right at the top of the segment here. I mean, this sort of alarming idea that that what we have is sort of gerrymandering on steroids this time around that really could kind of devour our democracy. Is that an overstatement? Do you agree with it? How would you add to that?
I think that that's a real risk. I mean, I think lots of people have sort of shared the concern that Jack raised, in part because, there are fewer legal constraints, but also in part because map drawers will have more powerful data and technology at their disposal. It used to be in the old days you would draw 3 or 4 or 5 maps and pick the best out of 3 or 4 or 5, but now you can draw tens of thousands of maps using much, much more robust data about voters based on what kind of car you drive, what you post from Facebook or Instagram. All of that data sort of goes into composite model of each voter, and it's you're able to draw maps with micro precision as a result.
Right. Now, as we speak, Republicans have a majority in most state legislatures, so that gives them a big advantage in this effort to redistrict and really go after the balance of power in Washington. Can you talk a little bit about how big their advantage is and the consequences of that?
Yeah, the Republicans have a lopsided advantage when it comes to trying to win back the U.S. House. Republicans will have sole control over the drawing of 187 congressional districts this cycle. Democrats will only control 75 by comparison, and Democrats only control two large states, Illinois and New York. And so, really, whereas Republicans will control big states like Texas, Florida, Georgia, North Carolina, and out of those four states alone, they could potentially gerrymandering their way to a durable majority, not only in 2022, but really for the whole of the decade.
For the whole of the decade. Now, explain that. How would that work, cementing their power for the whole of the decade?
So the goal of gerrymandering is to make sure that your party wins as many seats as possible. And, to do that, you use technology to sort of spread your voters out very artfully and to pack in voters of the other party so that they don't really, until you dilute their voting power and you sort of enhance your voting power. And, you're able to, with this new technology, like sort of test out what will happen under a range of scenarios, like good years for Democrats, bad years for Democrats, good years for Republicans, bad years for Republicans. And using that, you're able to really render elections almost meaningless because the results will be predetermined. And that really sort of is antithetical to what the founding generation would have wanted, because we have elections every 2 years because, after all, they thought, like, as the mood of the people changes, so should the composition of Congress. But that doesn't really happen very much anymore. And if you look at Ohio, for example, Republicans drew a 12-4 map in Ohio. They have 12 seats. Democrats have 4. And all last decade, Republicans won 12 seats and Democrats won 4. And that's what you could see in much of the country as a result of, the aggressive gerrymandering this decade, which, again, the Supreme Court has greenlit.
Wow. So Democrats obviously very concerned about this. But when they have the power, don't they do the same thing? Or is there something qualitatively different about what Republicans are doing in this cycle?
Well, there's no question that Democrats, when given the chance, will aggressively gerrymander. In 1991, for example, Democrats aggressively gerrymandered Texas to give themselves a majority of the Texas congressional delegation, even though Texas was becoming a Republican state at the time. But the reality is that Democrats have a lot fewer opportunities to gerrymander just because they control fewer states, right? It's the fact that Republicans have sole control of a bunch of states, including some big ones like Texas and Florida, that give them such a lopsided advantage.
Right. I want to come to Texas and ask you a question about that, because Texas is an interesting example because there are big demographic changes in states like Texas, fueled overwhelmingly by people of color, a growing immigrant population. This should be a boon to Democrats, but Republicans are still in a pretty good position down there. And this issue that we're talking about is a big reason why, right?
Yeah, you know, you're absolutely right. 90% of Texas' population gain last decade was provided by communities of color, primarily the Latino community, but Texas also saw really fast growth in its Black and Asian communities. And you know, that's really why Texas gained two new congressional seats. But because Republicans have sole control of the process, Democrats fell short in trying to win one of the chambers of the Texas legislature in 2020. They will be able to do basically whatever they want, again, with the green light that the Supreme Court has provided, where it said, like, you know, as long as you're doing it for partisan reasons, that's okay. And what we saw last decade was that Republican-controlled legislatures in the South packed Black and Latino voters into districts and claimed that it was a Voting Rights Act that made them do it, and the court struck all of that down. But now they can pack Black and Latino voters into districts and claim simply they were packing Democrats into districts. And the fact that those Democrats happen to be Black and brown, that's just coincidental. And the Supreme Court has said it's perfectly okay to be aggressive for partisan purposes.
Michael, Renee Shapiro writes to us on a listener who writes this on Facebook. This is why we need the For the People Act to be passed to protect voting rights and prevent the sort of unfair redistricting currently being done. So talk a little bit about that. This is House Bill 1, For the People Act, which, among other things, I gather would make sort of overt partisan gerrymandering much more difficult to do.
Support for the On Point podcast comes from Indeed. If you need to hire, you need Indeed. Indeed is your matching and hiring platform that lets you find candidates fast. Ditch the busy work and use Indeed for scheduling, screening, and messaging so you can connect with candidates faster. And listeners get a $75 sponsored job credit to get your jobs more visibility at Indeed.com/onpoint. That's Indeed.com/onpoint. Terms and conditions apply. Need to hire? You need Indeed. Support for this podcast comes from Is Business Broken?, a podcast from Questrom School of Business. These days, it's hard to ignore the debate over the role business should play in society.
There's crescendo around profit, period. Is profit bad? Is capitalism evil? These themes are out there.
Is this criticism of business warranted? And if so, how do we fix it? Stick around until the end of this podcast for a preview of the first episode of the Is Business Broken podcast.
Yeah, there's no question that the For the People Act, which is H.R. 1 in the House and S.1 in the Senate, would be a game changer as far as redistricting goes. You know, it would ban partisan gerrymandering by statute. The Supreme Court has said there are no partisan gerrymandering claims under the Constitution, but Congress has the power to ban partisan gerrymandering by statute, which the For the People Act would do. The For the People Act also would strengthen protections for communities of color and add transparency provisions and make sure the public is able to participate in the process and make litigating and fighting about maps in court much more streamlined and efficient. And so it would be a total game changer, especially in these states that have aggressive gerrymandering.
Total game changer, of course. The prospect of passage in the Senate does not look bright at this moment. We're looking at the brewing battle over redistricting. Up next, we'll head to Florida, where a newly apportioned congressional seat could help determine the majority in the U.S. House in 2022. Michael Lee, Jack Beatty, stand by. We'll be back with more. I'm Anthony Brooks. This is On Point. This is On Point. I'm Anthony Brooks. We're talking this hour about how congressional districts are redrawn every 10 years and how Republicans have a big advantage in the process right now because of their dominance in state legislatures and what all this means about the state of American democracy and the balance of power in Washington for years to come. In Tulsa on Tuesday, President Biden promised to, quote, fight like heck against Republicans' efforts to pass restrictive voting laws.
As for the act of voting itself, I urge voting rights groups in this country to begin to redouble their efforts now to register and educate voters. And in June should be a month of action on Capitol Hill.
And in the first break, we talked about that Supreme Court case in 2019 in which the High Court ruled 5-4 that federal courts cannot decide if extreme partisan gerrymandering violates the Constitution. Justice Elena Kagan delivered a passionate dissent.
these gerrymanders dishonored our democracy, turning upside down the core American idea that all governmental power derives from the people. These gerrymanders enabled politicians to entrench themselves in office against voters' preferences. They promoted partisanship above respect for the popular will. They encouraged a politics of polarization and dysfunction. Left unchecked, as the court does today, gerrymanders like these may irreparably damage our system of government.
This hour, I'm joined by Michael Lee. He's senior counsel at the Brennan Center's Democracy Program, and Jack Beatty, On Point News analyst. And Jack, you heard Michael sort of lay it out. You started us off this hour. You heard Michael lay it out with a little more detail. What are you thinking about sort of where we are right now at this moment?
Well, one way to look at it, and Michael brings this out in his paper, is that the demographic surge in the country, especially in the Southeast, which by the year 2030 will see a majority of younger Americans will be people of color. That demographic surge, which Democrat optimists used to say pointed to a good future for them, that's being held up by redistricting and maybe even cabined and subverted by gerrymandering. So there's a kind of there's a real incentive for Republicans in Florida, Republicans in Texas, Republicans in Georgia and North Carolina, the states that Michael identifies as the riskiest for flagrant gerrymandering. That's their motive, to keep this demographic surge out of the picture, out of American history, maybe for another decade, by packing such voters into single districts. And then you get districts like the district that Jim Clyburn has in South Carolina. I think it's the 6th district. And he wins his election 68-65. He won his last election 68-30. And people say, wait a minute, if that district, you could get maybe two Democrats. In other words, if they spread those Democrats around, maybe another Republican would go out. But the Republicans cabin them into these majority-minority districts where the people like Jim Clyburn rack up these super majorities.
Well, speaking of Florida, I want to introduce Carlos Trujillo. He's the founder of Democracy Now! It's a new advocacy group that's focused on redistricting in Florida. Carlos Trujillo is a Republican. He's a former Florida state rep and the former ambassador to the Organization of American States for the Trump administration. And Carlos Trujillo, Ambassador Trujillo, welcome to On Point. Thanks for joining us.
Thank you for having me.
So I'd love you to define Democracy Now!'s mission. What's its goal, particularly in the context of what we're talking about right now, redistricting in Florida?
Well, our goal is to make sure citizens participate in the process. The process should not be controlled by outside groups that are mostly funded by liberal activists out of California who use our legislative process to try to influence the process and ultimately try to use the courts to change the will of the democratically elected officials.
But can you respond to this general idea that we're facing a challenge to democracy in this country with the idea of gerrymandering, which is sort of this concept where politicians seem to be choosing their voters rather than the other way around?
I think we have to put it in context.
Yeah, right? Go ahead.
Gerrymandering has been around for decades. For anyone to come and say the motive in Florida, North Carolina, and Texas is to suppress minorities from participating in the process. Number one, the facts don't stipulate to that. And number two, we have to look at general election data in these states to determine whether Texas and Florida and North Carolina are voting Democrats. And at least based on the 2020 election, that is not the case. What I can tell you, though, is being a former elected official in Florida and having watched closely the 2020 legislative elections, the amount of outside money that was being poured into Texas and particularly into Florida down ballot at some of these races was only for the intent of trying to influence the redistricting process. They were unsuccessful because Florida still has a supermajority Republican in the House and the Senate. But for people to say that there was no intent and the intents are always pure, obviously politics is partisan.
Right.
And like any partisan nature, as we've seen in California in the Orange County seats, people try to draw a partisan advantage.
So you have said that the path to a Republican majority in the U.S. House runs through Florida. So talk a little bit about that. Talk about the opportunity that Republicans have in Florida to help alter the balance of power in Washington. What are you looking at?
Well, I think the path to the majority runs through Florida, whether it's Republican or Democrat. I think one interesting thing you've seen in Florida, Florida has added one additional seat by population growth. But you've also seen very competitive seats, the likes of Congressman Charlie Crist announcing that he's not seeking reelection. He's running for governor of Florida. The likes of Val Demings announcing that she is not seeking reelection. There's talks that Congresswoman Stephanie Murphy might not seek reelection. So I think there's a lot of shifts just within the Democratic bench in Florida, and all those are relatively competitive seats. But you've also seen massive population growth in Central Florida. And some of that population growth has been Puerto Ricans relocating in Central Florida, but a lot of it has also been Midwesterners who are moving to Florida because of the no state income tax.
Right. And just to put this in perspective, so Democrats right now in the House of Representatives in Washington have a slim majority of 4 members. In Florida, there are 5 vacancies in the House. You mentioned that you'll be getting an extra seat. So really, Florida alone, if you manage to flip those seats toward the Republicans, could be responsible for reclaiming the Republican majority in the House, right? I mean, this is really what we're talking about. It's just a few votes, and one state could do it.
Yeah, absolutely, and I think we also have to study history, right? Democrats control the House, the Senate, and the executive. Usually going into midterm elections, the party that controls all 3 branches of government does not historically do well. Then you have the demographic shifts of states like New York losing representation due to population. California is in the same boat. So I think overall, the paradigm of controlling all axes of power, plus some of the states that are more friendly to Democratic electorates are losing representation. It really can lead to a scenario in which Republicans take back the House and possibly even the Senate.
I want to come back, though, to your focus on outside money as politicizing this process in an unfair way, because what I hear you saying, and you can correct me if I'm wrong, but it seems like you're, I don't know, giving short shrift to the idea of gerrymandering within a state and the kind of corrosive influence that might have on the political process and in encouraging certain populations, discouraging certain populations from participating in the democratic process. I mean, isn't gerrymandering a problem, Mr. Trujillo?
No, I think gerrymander has always been a problem. I don't think it's anything new. It's not something that was just discovered in 2020. There's a litany of cases that have gone to the Supreme Court on gerrymandering. But I think the fine balance, and someone earlier said, is why does Jim Clyburn perform at 80%? There's also the Federal Voting Rights Act. I'm a former representative in a Hispanic community that represented a minority access seat. We have to look at historical discrimination, and we have to look at the Federal Voting Rights Act before we start going down the path of eliminating minority access seats. And my fear is that we oftentimes use the word gerrymandering, as was previously said, to then start attacking minority access seats. Hmm. That is a very, very dangerous road that we cannot go down.
You have to spell that out for me a little bit more, because I'm not really understanding what you're saying,
go ahead. Example that if we get Representative Clyburn's seat, and instead of it performing at 80% Democrat, it performs at 50% Democrat. And we move that other 30% and we put it in a Republican seat, and now that Republican seat becomes Democrat. But we also have to look at the Federal Voting Rights Act. Maybe both those seats become Democrat, but maybe it's at the cost of having an African-American representative. Does that advance? First, is it in compliance with the Federal Voting Rights Act, which is one analysis in and of itself? And number two, does it advance democracy? In Florida, we have seats that are drawn for minority access, whether it's Hispanic or African-American. If we divide those seats and reshift the population in African-American communities or Hispanic communities, would a certain party perform better? Maybe, maybe not. Will minority communities be able to elect officials that represent them, look like them, and are from their neighborhoods? And the answer is maybe or maybe not. I think it's a very fine balance of we need to get Clyburn's seat and cut it up so that we have more Democrats. But if that's the cost of African Americans having less representation in Congress or Hispanics having less representation in Congress, we have to be very, very careful. It's a fine line and one that we have to be careful as we approach.
Michael Lee, let me bring you back into this conversation. I'd love you to respond to what Carlos Trujillo is saying, the caution that he is offering here, that perhaps looking for ways to spread out minority representation might actually cost them representation.
Well, you know, it is true that, you know, you want to protect representation for communities of color, but it's also true that Republicans last decade sort of went overboard in packing Black districts and in some cases Latino districts in states like Texas, you know, well beyond what they needed to do to perform to elect Black preferred or Latino preferred candidates. And you saw that in Virginia, where a court struck down the state's congressional plan as a racial gerrymander, an unconstitutional racial gerrymander, and ordered it to be redrawn. And the result of that redrawing was to create a second Black ability to elect district in Virginia. And so, and likewise, you know, you could easily, you know, create additional minority opportunities for the Latino community in Texas if you sort of undid some of the cracking and packing there. And so, it is a appropriate concern, but, you know, I think sometimes it's used as a pretextual excuse.
Carlos Trujillo, I have one last question for you. In the last cycle of redistricting, Florida's Supreme Court struck down GOP-drawn maps in 2015, ruling that they had been gerrymandered to favor the Republican Party. Was the court right? And if so, have you changed the way you were thinking about redistricting?
No, I believe the court was wrong. And I think one of the examples is one of the members of that Supreme Court now works for the League of Women Voters. So I think the court was completely wrong. And that member of the court, their opinion was you have to look into the inner feelings of the members as they voted on the maps. What you have to look is at the maps on their their face, right? Mm-hmm. Do they support one person, one vote? Are they compact? Do they comply with the Florida constitutional provisions, Amendment 3 and 4? And also, do they comply with the Federal Voting Rights Act? Going into the minutiae of the person's inner feelings as they vote for a bill or legislation is really not in the realm of the court. And ultimately, that's where they went. And the outcome was, unfortunately, Corinne Brown, representative from Jacksonville, in a minority access seat, lost her seat. Dwight Bullard, an African-American representative in South Florida, lost their seat. And ultimately, the balance of power in Florida did not shift. For the most part, the House, the State House and the State Senate more or less have the same amount of numbers, and so does the congressional delegation.
Hmm. You've talked at the beginning of the break about the corrosive effects of outside money politicizing this, but I'm curious about what you make of efforts in a number of states, and we're going to hear from one of them, Michigan, in the next segment, that are aiming to take partisanship out of the process by setting up redistricting commissions, nonpartisan redistricting commissions. Good idea?
I think it's a terrible idea. Members are elected by their communities. They run for re-election and they're accountable. You know who your representatives and you know who your senator is. You have no idea who sits on this commission. So you create an unelected bureaucratic function that claims to be nonpartisan. It would be interesting to ask these people in Michigan. I know they couldn't agree on whether they should say the Pledge of Allegiance prior to starting their duties. That is a nonpartisan thing. How could you not agree on the Pledge of Allegiance? But then you look into their personal history, ask them all, did they show up and vote for President of the United States and leave it blank because they have no partisan opinion? Did they show up and vote in the congressional and senatorial races and leave them blank because they have no partisan opinion?
Yeah, but with respect, you could say that about any nonpartisan commission. You know, of course, people on nonpartisan commissions vote.
I think that's the point.
Yeah.
And that's the point, right? There's no such thing as a nonpartisan commission. I think that's the point, right? They all have their partisan preferences. For someone to say that they're truly nonpartisan, unless they're a jurist and they take an oath and they show up and really just follow the law and follow the Constitution and the facts and apply them, everyone has a partisan perspective. I have a partisan perspective. Everyone does.
Yeah.
So for someone to say that, oh, I have no partisan perspective and I just check it at the door and no one knows who I am, I've never been elected, I'm unaccountable, no one could vote me in or out of office, I think it's very, very dangerous. Because we can start saying that about everything. Why don't we do that in Congress? Why don't we create a nonpartisan commission to pass budget reform or to pass immigration reform.
Well, of course, nonpartisan commissions have been set up over the years to think about and improve a lot of American institutions. But I take your point, and I'll put those questions to our guests from Michigan in the next segment. Carlos Trujillo, he's the founder of Democracy Now!, a nonprofit advocacy group focused on redistricting in Florida, and he's the former ambassador to the Organization of American States for the Trump administration. Thank you so much for joining us. We really appreciate it.
Thank you so much for having me.
It was our pleasure. And Michael Lee, just a few seconds before we move toward the break, respond to that last idea about these commissions, and we're going to be hearing from one, in terms of what Mr. Trujillo was saying.
Well, it's a little bit of a straw man to say that, you know, people have partisan views. You know, the way that commissions work is they ensure that any map that gets passed has bipartisan support. So people do have partisan views, but you have to win support across party lines. And that doesn't happen right now in states like Florida, where Republicans get to make all of the decisions, oftentimes decisions made behind closed doors. And instead, in states like Michigan, you've got to get Democratic support, Republican support, and independent support in order to pass a map.
We are talking about the brewing battle of drawing congressional district maps in 2021. Up next, we're going to hear about reforms in Michigan that aim to take partisanship out of the redistricting process. Tell us what you think. Leave us a comment on Facebook and Twitter at On Point Radio. My guests are Michael Lee with the Brennan Center's Democracy Program and Jack Beatty, On Point News Analysts. I'm Anthony Brooks. We're going to take a short break. We'll be right back. This is On Point.
Did you kill Marlene Johnson?
I think you're one of the first people to have actually asked.
From WBUR and ZSP Media, this is Beyond All Repair, a new podcast about an unsolved murder that will leave you questioning everything.
Somebody should be in jail for murdering my sister.
A woman who's never been believed.
As long as they think I have done this, then they're not looking for who actually did this.
And that's what makes it a cold case.
No, it's a botched case.
And a search for the truth, once and for all.
Wow, it just gets more interesting.
Beyond All Repair. Listen and follow wherever you get your podcasts.
Be careful. You're digging in a place that's been very peaceful for a while.
Do it anyway. Dig.
This is On Point. I'm Anthony Brooks. We're talking this hour about congressional redistricting, the challenge of gerrymandering, and the balance of power in Washington heading into the 2022 midterm elections, which in this case appears to be favoring Republicans in a big way. I'm going to read a couple of comments from our listeners on Twitter. Ben McCrory writes, trying to win votes through policies and principles is such an antiquated idea these days. Best just to cheat and steal and stop the other guy voting or make his vote void. And here's Guy, who writes, please highlight Missouri. In 2018, we voted overwhelmingly for an independent redistricting body by amendment, only to have the legislature put a nearly identical proposition on the November 2020 ballot to make the body governor appointed, overturning the people's will. My guests this hour, On Point News analyst Jack Beatty and Michael Lee, senior counsel at the Brennan Center's Democracy Program. And Michael, before I move on, can you respond to what Guy is referring to there?
Yeah, in Missouri in 2018, voters overwhelmingly approved a constitutional amendment by ballot initiative that created an independent map drawer for the state and strengthen the rules for how maps are going to be drawn. But the legislature quite deviously came back and proposed something that made it sound like they were actually improving the redistricting, but actually sort of went back to the old system that Missouri had, which was deadlock and abuse prone. And it just goes to show you that even lawmakers now understand how popular redistricting reform is and how if they're going to sort of do something underhanded, they have to make it sound like it's reform. So. Mm.
Well, we're going to move on and bring another voice into the conversation. Joining us now from Detroit, Michigan, is Brittany Kellum. She's chair of the Michigan Independent Citizens Redistricting Commission. She's a Democrat. She's also a trauma practitioner and founder of Just Speak, a nonprofit advocacy organization centered on childhood trauma. And Brittany, welcome. Brittany Kellum, welcome to On Point. Thanks so much for joining us.
Hi, Anthony. It's a pleasure and honor to be here. How are you today?
Well, I'm very well, and all the better for having you on the program. Tell us about the commission, the redistricting commission that you're a part of, and how it came to fruition.
So here's a little background. In 2018, Michigan voters took fate into their own hands and drastically shifted the redistricting process by adopting Proposal 2. So instead of, as many have already mentioned, instead of legislators drawing the lines for their best interests, citizens would draw the lines that represent their best interests and respect historical, cultural, and economic perspectives. So the Michigan Independent Citizens Redistricting Commission, a mouthful, but the MICRC leads that redistricting process, and we are the sole entity that is responsible for this daunting task, the 13 of us.
And how were the 13 of you put together? Right, I mentioned that you're a Democrat. The commission is supposed to be nonpartisan. How do you ensure that the commission is nonpartisan?
So we were randomly selected from over 9,000 applicants, and there are 13 of us, but we have four folks who affiliate with the Democratic Party, five independents who do not affiliate with either major party, and four who affiliate with the Republican Party. And that is our makeup. That's what makes us nonpartisan. That's what makes us independent. We really do check those beliefs at the door.
Mm. And I'm curious as well, because we're talking about demographic changes. I mean, we were talking a moment ago about big demographic changes in the South and Southwest. Michigan, perhaps a different story. But what does this process mean for voters of color in Michigan in particular?
It's a huge process. Historically, there hasn't been a lot of trust or even awareness, I would say, an awareness as to how the injustices of the process is, it could be unfair and disempowering. But I think this new opportunity where Michigan voters, 61%, right, voted to have this redistricting commission gives way to a new way of thinking, a new way of giving voice. We truly are everyday citizens. I think someone before me remarked that was maybe a negative point, but I think it's a highlight that we are transparent. We're giving our best efforts. We have supports that I think bolster our efforts. And I think people, Black and brown folks, can begin to explore the process of voting and democracy in a way that's curious, comfortable, and really make sure that we're tapping into their communities, because that's what we're doing now. We're going around and listening to these different communities and getting their input of what matters most to them.
So you mentioned the concerns that were raised in our last segment by Carlos Trujillo of Florida, and I promised him that I'd put his questions and concerns to you. He called it, as you sort of alluded to, he called the idea of supposed nonpartisan commissions a terrible idea because you're nothing more than a group of unelected bureaucrats who aren't accountable to the voters. What's your response to that?
He's absolutely right. We are a non-political group. We are everyday citizens. And I think that is the exact point. I think it's a wonderful idea, an idea that is supported by the folks that voted for us and is a huge signal that change is something that is not just dreamed about, but it's being demanded. We are mandated to do this job. So I think, you know, while his opinions might be valid, because we're all allowed to have those, I think the data and the experience that we've been having thus far with our public hearings shows the exact opposite. People are yearning for this opportunity to vocalize the things that happen in their community, and also the things that matter most, which is change. There's been an overwhelming response and need for change.
Michael Lee, I'd love to draw you back into this conversation, because we were talking before before Brittany came on the air about what happened in Missouri. I think it was back in 2008. And I'm just curious if you know what sort of public polling tells us in general about this issue and how folks feel about redistricting and the best way to engage with this part of the political process.
So if you were to go back 10 or 15 years ago, you looked at polling about redistricting or gerrymandering, it didn't register with voters at all. It didn't move people one way or the other. People didn't understand what the words were even. But that's totally changed in the last few years, and particularly after the aggressive gerrymandering in 2011. And now in states like Michigan and Ohio, people will tell you when they went to collect signatures in Michigan, they would go door to door at very mixed partisan neighborhoods. They would knock on Democratic doors, they would knock on Republican doors, and everyone was ready to sign the petition when they said that we're taking power away from politicians. And it really goes to show you that people do think that something is broken increasingly. And you see that consistently in polling about the For the People Act and any number of reform measures around the country. People think that something is broken in our democracy, and they think that redistricting is a big part of that.
Interesting. I'm curious, Brittany, I know that this process is just beginning for you, but in terms of redistricting, can you forecast any changes? I mean, what Michigan is going to look like after this process is completed? Is it going to be more Democratic, less Democratic, more Republican, less Republican? What can you tell us about how this will play out?
I wish I had the magic crystal ball, right? But I think that is that's the beauty of the process, that we truly have not began to draw anything. And that would be against, the Constitution and what we have promised and professed in our mission and our responsibilities. What I can say is that with transparency and with fairness, we are going to do our due diligence to make sure that our process fits the criteria that's outlined by the Michigan Constitution. You know, our district shall be geographically contiguous. It'll reflect the state's diverse population. And we have other criteria that we make sure that we're meeting while we are redrawing these lines.
Hmm. Michael Lee, other states that are involved in this kind of process with nonpartisan commissions to work out redistricting, how many are there? Who tops the list with this particular approach to this challenge?
So four states have what we would consider independent commissions: California and Arizona, and then they're joined this decade by Michigan and Colorado. A number of states also have have what we call bipartisan commissions, where there's more political involvement in the appointment of the commissioners. But four states have what we consider independent commissions, and there's a lot of evidence that they really work well. And California is a great example of that. As Democrats win more votes, they win more seats. As Republicans win more votes, they win more seats. And in fact, it's notable that a quarter of the seats that Republicans picked up in 2020 were in California under the commission drawn map. So, and that's really what most people think the democracy should look like.
Hmm. Jack Beatty, we outlined a pretty alarming view at this at the top of the hour. Does this approach, putting this in the hands of nonpartisan commissions, sound like a good solution to you going forward?
It sounds like a solution but not necessarily for the temper of this country today. I mean, I'm just terribly afraid that I'm heartened that there's such bipartisan support for this, but I'm afraid that substantial Republican politicking and electioneering and haranguing around this could sink support among Republicans for it, because they would recognize that the fairer the system is, the more Democrats are apt to be represented. So I think there is tenuous bipartisan support for the idea, but that's in tension with the driving central dynamic of American politics today, which is extreme polarization and the growth among the Republicans of anti-democratic sentiment, anti-democratic with a small d.
Mm. Brittany Kellum, respond to that. I mean, this idea that it's a workable solution, but maybe not a solution, as Jack says, for the temper of this country today, given the divisiveness. What do you think?
Well, I think, it's an opportunity for something different to be done. And I don't think it's an opportunity. I don't say that lightly, as though, we're just playing around and make believe. This is a very serious task. And I think if anything, it's an opportunity for other places and for folks to get their gears turning in a different way. And we're not going to make everyone happy. We're not. And that also is okay. It doesn't have to be a perfect solution, but one that at least elevates the conversation of fairness.
Well, Brittany Kellum, she's chair of the Michigan Independent Citizens Redistricting Commission. Brittany Kellum, thank you so much for joining us today and bringing this important perspective to the discussion. We really appreciated having you.
Thank you so much for having me.
And Michael and Jack, we've got just a few minutes left. I guess I want to get at the bigger, not the bigger, but another sort of big theme here. And that is this really fundamental idea of democracy, that everyone needs to be counted, that a healthy democracy counts on broad participation of its citizens. So, Michael, I want to start with you on this. How does the status quo, which, you know, leaves room for political gerrymandering and all the stuff we've been talking about, discourage people from being civically engaged?
Well, you know, when I lived in Texas many years ago, like, you would oftentimes hear people say, like, why even bother voting? Because, you know, they've already determined who the winner is, right? And in states that are badly gerrymandered, like Texas, you know, there really is a palpable perception that people have put the thumb on the scale, and it's a correct perception, to sort of rig the maps in advance. And I think that is, you know, something that, you know, is deeply harmful to democracy, right? And when you look at a state like North Carolina, you know, where it's a 50-50 state, it's a perpetual battleground, and yet the map that was drawn last decade produced 10 Republicans and 3 Democrats. And when asked at one point why they drew a 10-3 map, the Republican leader said, because we couldn't figure out how to draw an 11-2 map, right? And and that's not what democracy is supposed to look like. It's supposed to, you know, it's, you know, like John Adams famously said that, you know, Congress, that state legislature should be an exact portrait, a miniature of the people as a whole. And that's really what the goal is, to, you know, like, you know, have the people there in all of their diversity, not only political, but racial and ethnic and community and, you know, religious and everything there at the table. And that's how we're supposed to make decisions. And that doesn't happen because people prioritize partisanship over everything else and put their thumb on the scale to make sure that they get there.
Mm. Jack Beatty, add to that. What are you thinking? Same question. I mean, how this discourages people from participating in democracy.
Well, it would be hard to prove that from the last election where turnout was up, but we're going to see it in the congressional election. Turnout in 2014, for example, I think it barely got into 30%. And that's because people recognize their vote doesn't count. Essentially, the politicians have already picked who's going to win. And, of course, they picked it with the help of software that you know, in Wisconsin, for example, the Republican gerrymandering there was compared really to Volkswagen. Do you remember when Volkswagen was indicted and had embarrassed by people finding that its anti-admissions software only kicked in when the car was being inspected? Otherwise, it spewed out onto the road. Well, that's the model of what the Republicans did in their plan for Wisconsin with computer, you know, gymnastics. They created a system where the more votes the Democrats got, the almost the stronger the Republican response could be. It's like a system that was proof against all but the strongest Democratic wave. Mm. That's a victory for minority rule, not democracy.
Very quickly, Michael Lee, literally 10 seconds left. What should we expect in the months to come? What are you looking at as the sort of next moment in this story?
Well, I think it's going to be a really challenging and fraught cycle, and there will be lots of efforts to sort of like rush the process and to use the fact that redistricting is occurring later than normal to shut the public out and to do as much as possible behind closed doors.
All right. Well, not much at stake, just our democracy, nothing more than that. Michael Lee, senior counsel at the Brennan Center's Democracy Program, thank you so much for joining us today. We're very grateful.
Thank you for having me.
And Jack Beatty, On Point News analyst. Always great to talk to you, Jack. Thanks for being with us.
Thank you, Anthony.
On Point is produced by Anna Bauman, Jonathan Chang, Eileen Amata, Stefano Katsonis, Hillary McQuilkin, James Ross, Dory Scheimer, Tim Skog, and Sydney Wertheim. Our executive producer is Jonathan Dyer. Thanks for joining us today. I'm Anthony Brooks. This is On Point.
Support for this podcast comes from Is Business Broken, a podcast from Questrom School of Business. Listen on for a preview of one of the episodes featuring Susan Fournier, Alan Questrom Professor, and Dean.
So let's start this conversation with the title of the show, Is Business Broken? It's a provocative title and a question. Where did this come from? Why that question now?
We're in a big cultural moment where capitalism, business, market systems are really being scrutinized and debated, and the role of business with it. So I think the question is just on the table. It's on people's minds. It's in the news media. It's in conversations. I think there are growing voices, loud voices, especially among young people who seem increasingly to believe that business and maybe capitalism with it are harmful and create rather than solve problems for society. And what we do seem to hear are those loud voices, and they are very black and white. There are protagonists and the antagonists and the pros and the cons, and there's really no middle discussion. It's sort of like people for and against, and it's loud.
Right. For and against DEI, for instance, right? A battle at play.
Right.
The way you describe it and the way you describe the polarization, it makes it feel like very much of the digital age, right? It feels very much of today. Some of those arguments have been around, though, right? Is this criticism of business and this question, is business broken, is that a new question?
You are so right. It is not a new question. Schumpeter, he was a professor at Harvard, and he's also maybe one of the most influential political economists of the early 20th century. He called for the death of capitalism, the death of business, 100 years ago.
Okay. Wow.
And when he critiqued way back then, he said the very successes of capitalism would bring about its downfall because it would create values hostile to capitalism, and that this would particularly take hold among intellectuals who were critiquing. So there's a lot of that same kind of dynamic happening today, and that's 100 years old. But yeah, we've seen this kind of cultural fervor playbook many times in the past, often precipitated by big crises.
Find the full episode by searching for Is Business Broken wherever you listen to podcasts, and learn more about the Mehrotra Institute for Business, Markets, and Society at ibms.bu.edu.